Are we ready for the first question? Cecilia, no, Adrian. Adrian. Okay. This one will take us through the first hour. Adrian, when I first got into Dharma practice, I had somewhat turned my back on my Christian roots, but in the past year have been deeply inspired and moved by Christian contemplatives such as Thomas Merton and St. John, and find that it actually benefits my Dhamma practice, and felt like I have experienced God's presence in my meditations, even though I cannot conceptualize God. I feel like what I was fed as a child was not authentic, and feel that I am starting to experience God in a way that makes sense and feels true. To me, I don't feel like it's one or the other, Buddhist or Christian, but I am hearing so much truth in the teachings of Christ as well as the Buddha. What are your thoughts on all of this? Is it possible to have faith in a loving, caring God, and at the same time be a devout Dhamma practitioner? There is so much beauty in both traditions. I feel that the Christian truths have been corrupted by ignorant people. Okay. One thing I liked about Buddhism was that it sticks close to what we can know. Do you want to close the door? Thanks. Because if you feel something, then how do you, beyond that basic feeling, it's mostly just projection as to what it is. To say one has experienced God, so well. How do you know? How do you know for sure? And that's why in Christianity, the whole question of belief is such a critical leap, and why it's so important in that tradition. Whereas in Buddhism, the idea of belief doesn't play such an important role. There are certain things that, certain areas where faith do come in, but it's more like a working faith, sort of like a hypothesis that say, well, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but I'll test it out for myself. I think with any religions, you're going to find a lot in common. You're going to find areas where it's just part of, human nature, that when we act in a particular way, then it's going to have beneficial effects. So certainly on the level of sila, usually, there can be a lot in common, on the level of being a good person. But then even on the level of sila, you can, depending on how literally you're taking various scriptures, even something like relationship to animals, whereas if a holy book is saying that you've got rights to use animals any way that you wish, for example, then you can end up making a lot of bad karma that way. So I think it depends a lot on personal interpretation as well. I mean, something like there's probably as many definitions of God as there are people who believe it. At some level, it doesn't work to have a belief in an eternal, omniscient God and to be following the path of purification of heart through the Buddhist teachings. They diverge at a certain point. For example, the first step on the Noble Eightfold Path is right view, and so part of that is the Buddha very clearly goes through and describes what that is. And there's one sutta in the Digha Nikaya where he goes through and discusses all of the major views, religious views at that particular time. It's called the Brahmajala Sutta. And it goes through the 62 major religious views that were current at his time. And generally the views would go into the sides of eternalist views and annihilationist views. And the eternalist views would in some way conceive of something as eternal, whether it's some external eternal entity, like a god, or a internal entity, sort of like an undying, unchanging soul. The other side was annihilationist, which was more in the camp of, well, it's all just elements arising and passing away, but there was nothing before and there's nothing afterwards, so nothing really matters. Even conventional morality doesn't matter. So in terms of developing deep insight, then an eternalist viewpoint would block insight. Right? So if there's, it's funny how the mind works, but if it's programmed to believe in a particular, that something is eternal and unchanging, then that will tend to make it impossible to see anicca or anatta deep enough. So the short answer is yes, there's with any grouping of spiritual paths you can kind of combine them in a certain way which works, but in the end, to take one very deeply or to take any of them very deeply, it's important just to focus on one. Is seeking insight into one's kilesas considered vipassana meditation? Or is vipassana limited to seeking insight into ultimate reality issues like emptiness? Can you say more about the intersection between common and ultimate reality? The term vipassana wasn't actually used by the Buddha all that much, compared to the ways that we would normally sum up his teachings. And when it did occur in the suttas, it was always conjoined with like samatha and vipassana, or samadhi and vipassana. They would go together. And it was a general term referring to insight into one's into the nature of reality. Right? But basically, understanding the nature of reality is going to, at the same time, be insight into one's kilesas, one's how one's relating to that, how one's relating to the reality. So as soon as there's real insight, that it's going to start to uproot delusion. It's going to start to replace delusion with knowledge, with understanding. It's going to start replacing ignorance with wisdom. And that just undermines any movement towards being greedy or any movement towards being angry. And when it talks about ultimate reality issues like emptiness, you know, originally the Buddha didn't speak about emptiness all that much. And it wasn't considered like the one of the primary things that would come into play for insight. You know, anicca, impermanence, dukkha, the nature of unsatisfactoriness, and anatta, insight into non-self. Now, these were really the main tools that the Buddha was encouraging people to use. There are suttas on emptiness, but it was also almost like a tool that you could use in order to contemplate things. And basically, it's just another way of looking at something. You know, if you see one of these characteristics, you're going to see all of them. Ajahn, can you speak to the difference between desire and intent? How can one let go of attachment to outcome and still maintain commitment and persevere with intention? Well, in Pali you have the words tanha, which is desire, which is more an unwholesome desire, which is going to be leading to suffering of some kind, whether it's big or small. And then you've got the word chanda, which, especially dhamma chanda, which is the desire to practice the dhamma. And the desire to practice the Dhamma, the Buddha considered essential. You can't do without it, because you need to have some motivation, some momentum to start. Otherwise, we won't even have the won't even make the effort to come on a retreat. You know, and everything they would go through on a retreat, all the discomfort that we go through on the retreat. You know, it takes a certain wish, a certain seeking. And so even when you're working with Dhammachanda, a lot of time it's important to make sure we're working with it in the right balance. It's important to have, I think, like a guiding star in the distance that we're aiming towards, and then however far we get going in that direction, well, we just accept, you know, however far we get. But the most important thing is that we're heading in the right direction. A lot of the progress in meditation, especially in certain stages of meditation, will come not through wishing and hoping and desiring, certainly not through craving, but will come actually through just being very content with the way things are. Being very at peace with the way things are and allowing the mind to settle into that. And then that deepens of its own accord. So it's almost like there's a contradiction there, that the quickest way to make progress is to just be totally content with the way things are right now. And to be totally content means that, okay, maybe it will never get any better than this. But somehow there's still a satisfaction in putting forth effort. There's a contentment in just continuing on doing it. Right? It's a balance. You know, there's a matter of keeping the big picture in mind and the purpose of what we're doing and how all the different parts of practice fit together and relate to the big picture. And I think that's important to keep in mind. But you know, if you have a good experience sometime, I feel like that was a really good meditation, and then you wish to get it back, and you crave to get it back, you hope to get it back, and keep practicing, hoping to that it's going to happen again, that's not the cause and condition for it to happen again. It may have happened because you are perfectly content, or because you are sustaining awareness on your meditation, or because the factors in the mind had come into balance. So craving for progress is counterproductive, so that doesn't work. So there's a fine balance there between being very content with the results and yet keeping that enthusiasm for Dhamma practice going by creating the causes and conditions. Okay, we're getting a lot of very theoretical questions. It's good to have questions which are kind of relating to one's practice and meditation and not too out there. Does the movement of karma ever cease? That's his one. I don't think so. Not that I know. Okay. This one's clearly coming from your direct meditative experience. Ajahn, can I have a picture of you? Unfortunately, I don't have a camera. Well, maybe. Ajahn, once the body has been completely obliterated, someone's been taking this morning's meditation very literally, how can the question be asked, is this me? Since there is only space left, and space does not talk or ask questions. All right. Well, there's more to what we consider me than just the physical elements of the body, isn't there? I mean, there's thoughts, perceptions, moods, memories, emotions, consciousness. So that's what can be asking the question. Even if the body has, in our visualization, disappeared, we can still look at those emptiness, you know, look at the lack of elements or the disintegration of elements back into the earth and say, you know, what do these elements mean? Specifically with that meditation, it's when we're looking at the various piles or looking at how our body looks. You know, for example, sitting as a skeleton or a pile of bones. You know, it's just something that we identify with. And if so, it's just good to look at it and say, oh, yeah, actually, you know, I do identify with my thigh bone or my rib bone or my intestines or whatever. It's good just to look at that. But, you know, you can also identify with space element. We talk about earth element and the body, water element, and the fire element, which is the heat of the body, and the air element, which is kind of the cohesive factor. And you have consciousness element, which is the mental realm. But then you also have space element. And, you know, even empty space, can you identify with empty space? If someone put their finger in your mouth, would you identify with the space in your mouth? You're saying, get out of my space, man. You're infringing on my space. And they say, well, it's just empty space. It's not yours. Yeah. Well, or the space in your ears. You know, go inside the ears. There's all this space in there. And we can still identify with that empty space as being us. Ajahn, I've mostly looked at sitting as a practice of being in the present moment. When you start to think of achieving something and becoming kinder, more aware, enlightened, isn't that already taking you away from the present moment? How can you make the most productive... How can you make the most productive and without lofty goals? Something. And... So with the Noble Eightfold Path, for every factor there, you've got, for it to be working right, you've got both mindfulness and right effort. So the mindfulness part is just being aware of what already is in the present moment. Right? And then the right effort part is actually doing something about it. Right? I mean, and the right effort, what it means to be right, for any particular moment will depend. It'll always, you know, sometimes it means just being more mindful and carrying that on. Other times it means bringing up wholesome states of mind. The awareness part of it, like, well, all of the causes and conditions from the past have led us up to this moment. Right? And so there's nothing we can do about that anymore. You know, this has already happened. Then the first step is just to be aware of that, and that gives us a solid place to start. But, and although that is very powerful already, because that leads to a lot of self-awareness of, you know, what's actually going on. But that's certainly not the whole story, because then from that point on, once we have a realistic understanding or insight into what's going on in the present, then we can make the conscious decision to develop certain qualities and let certain other qualities go. And so right effort in that way is kind of time related, you know, in a sense. And it's happening in the present. But again, it's kind of the bit of a mixture between ultimate reality and conventional reality. Conventionally, yeah, there's an idea that we're working towards something better in the future. Whereas ultimate reality is, well, it's difficult to say if there is even is a future. It's just kind of one moment after the next. I think it's helpful to have certain inspiring goals of something that we could aim towards, head towards, just to kind of lead the mind in a particular direction. But again, the whole idea of achieving sometime is people can become obsessive about it in our culture. You know, there can be so much emphasis placed on achieving success, however you define success, that it's not peaceful. And so how we relate to that word, say, achieving, or how we even relate to the idea of success in Dhamma practice, you know, can be very different than the way that's encouraged in the mainstream. Ajahn, where do the thoughts come from? It seems that I can cut them off, but they keep coming and going. Where do the thoughts come from? Well, it's a natural function of the mind to think. So it's not the idea that meditation is meant to just get rid of all thinking, or that success in practice is like to get rid of all thinking. Because as Ajahn Piyik would say, he says, you know, the only person that doesn't think is a dead person. Even fully enlightened people are going to have thoughts coming up. It's just that, for one, the intention and motivation behind the thoughts are pure, and also there's like an inner quietude, and the thoughts aren't obsessively coming. So there's a lot more space, maybe in between the thoughts and around the thoughts. So thoughts are generally like echoes from all the sensory input that we take in, whether it's information that we read or conversations that we have or things that we see, things that we hear, and then quite often thoughts are just echoes from that. And a certain amount of practice is a matter of kind of cutting off things. You know, when a thought comes and it's kind of grabbing or inviting our attention to run off into some story, then yeah, it takes a certain like discipline and strength to just kind of cut it and say, no, not now. Or that's maybe not a useful thing to be thinking about right now. And then come back, especially when you're meditating, and just be able to catch it. And then very gently and firmly, just come back to the present and let it go. And thoughts are, it's just mental energy. So if we don't feed it more energy, then it just dissipates. Now certain thoughts can keep coming back again and again, and then that will be indicative of something that's going on below the surface, more like a reflection or an echo of something that's going on deeper in consciousness. And so just looking at the content of thought, or sometimes the feeling behind the thought, you can get an idea of something that's going on deeper. But also, thoughts can just be a distraction. You know, for example, you may sometimes when the meditation's starting to go well, and then suddenly there's just a raft of thoughts that start coming up as a distraction. And it's not usually the thoughts themselves that are the important factor, but if you can just go to what's right behind the thought. So, and sometimes that means just going back to a physical sensation or going back to more basic feeling behind the thoughts. And tune in on that, and then that can be the actual place where something's being clung to. So thoughts won't ever like totally go away, but there will be times when samadhi starts to settle in, thoughts become more and more peripheral, or they don't grab the intention so much, or they don't come as a constant stream. They may just come, you know, periodically, within the space of being grounded. Occasionally there'd be a thought coming up, another thought coming up, but it doesn't really shake the peace of the awareness. Okay. Ajahn, as I got deeper into the question, quote, is this me? Who is asking the question? Yeah, well, who is asking the question? That's the point, yeah. Is there a difference between awareness and consciousness? No, not really. Those are different terms, but essentially consciousness means, you know, the defining factor of consciousness is being aware. Is it possible to be aware of consciousness? Yes, in Buddhism we usually talk about consciousness referring to like sense consciousness, like the conscious of being, conscious of seeing. You know, seeing is actually like eye consciousness, and hearing is consciousness at the ear door, or consciousness of the mind. So you can be aware of being aware. It's usually like one moment afterwards, one very brief moment. Whenever we're aware of something, it has already just passed, and we're aware that of something that's just passed. And then something else happens, we're aware of that. And yes, you can be aware of consciousness, especially when the mind's more peaceful and there aren't a lot of other things disturbing the peace of the consciousness. So you can just be aware of that sense of spaciousness, but very clear, you know, there's a knowledge that you're aware, an understanding that you're aware. Is it possible to be aware and not conscious? No. I think if you're unconscious, just by definition, then there's no awareness. But it depends on what you mean by unconscious. I mean, you could have a near-death experience and kind of the body is not really conscious in a normal way. Your eyes may not be open, but there still might be consciousness around, or awareness around. So again, it depends on how you define consciousness, but if you're thinking of unconscious as like blacked out, then no, you can't be blacked out and be aware at the same time. Also, what is the Pali word for awareness? Sati. Sati. Mindfulness, awareness, attention, different definition, different translations for the word sati. John, the Buddha encouraged dwelling in cemeteries to contemplate death and decay of the body. Since bodies are now buried or burned after death, there are no longer bodies in sight to contemplate. I know. It's not like the good old days. Yeah. Ancient India was great. They just had bodies lying everywhere. I have heard that it is still recommended to take up temporary dwelling in cemeteries to contemplate death and spirits, as well as facing any fears of spirits and ghosts. Is this practice today? Please share your wisdom of this type of practice. Okay. There are many ways that dwelling in places like that can be practiced. Modern cemeteries are actually probably very peaceful places to go meditate, because you don't get a whole lot of people hanging out there making a lot of noise. And they can be kind of like nice peaceful parks. But they're parks dedicated to people who are dead. And so that in itself is a good reflection. You know, you look around a cemetery, you look at all the names and dates on the headstones, and sometimes a line of description about the person. And you think, how many people have lived and died in just, you know, even in just the short few hundred years that a lot of our cemeteries have been recording. Just how many people have lived and died, and it helps just to put one lifetime in perspective, because it's, you know, when we have this life, it feels like, well, this is the most important time in history. This is my life. But you know, in reality, this has been generation after generation after generation after generation, bodies arising, being born, growing old, and dying. And it just keeps carrying on. And we're just sort of the latest part of the human wave. So cemeteries can be, you know, practical reminders of that. Look, I'll talk about this more tonight, huh? I won't. This is a good one, and it is something that I think that it has a lot of potential there for insight, and contemplation of death in various ways has been used a lot for developing insight and letting go. Ajahn, why is Mahayana Buddhism considered to be the major vehicle? It's because they have because they pay the PR artists. Because they have good public relations, that's why. And they made up that term. And why is it considered to make enlightenment more available than Theravada Buddhism? Well, it's because that's just what they say. My understanding of the whole history of Buddhism is that obviously, in the time of the Buddhism, you didn't have any any different schools. You just had, you didn't even have Buddhism. What the Buddha called his teachings was Dhamma Vinaya. He didn't call it Buddhism or a Pali version of Buddhism. Dhamma Vinaya. The Dhamma we know is the teachings that we take refuge in. Vinaya meaning essentially sila or the monastic discipline, and then the two together form this lifestyle leading to liberation. Gradually after the Buddha passed away, and then different teachers would have slightly different emphases. You know, they may emphasize a certain part of the Dhamma teachings more than others. Even in the time of the Buddha, some of the teachers, like Mahamoggallana, were more, they were very skilled in deep samadhi and in the higher stages of practice. Someone like Sariputta, Venerable Sariputta, could expound the Dhamma just as well as the Buddha. So he had a very quick and analytical mind, as well as being fully enlightened. Someone like Mahakasapa, his nature was that he was very kind of tough and ascetic. So he kind of, his disciples tended to be kind of like that. He was a bit like the Ajahn Mahabua of the day, you know, pretty tough and ascetic. And, Ananda was like really kind and mellow, and with a good memory. So as after the Buddha passed away, then gradually, very gradually, more like different, they weren't even considered schools yet, but they would kind of have different flavors, and then over periods of hundreds of years, that could develop into, okay, well, this particular school or this school of thought. But even then, you would have people from different schools practicing and living in the same monasteries. So it wasn't all that, you know, it was still very harmonious. About 500 years after the Buddha passed away, then gradually there was a school that eventually developed into what it called itself, the Mahayana. And whenever there's, well, there were certain like defining features of that school, which did set it apart. And for example, one was raising the Bodhisattva ideal and lowering the Arhant ideal. That was probably one of the major ones. But any time that you have sort of a mainstream happening in a religion, and then some group wants to somehow break away from that or start something different, then you have to come up with some justification to do that. And especially since you say, well, the mainstream, you know, came from the Buddhist teaching, and then if you break away, how can you do any better than the original Buddhist teachings? So the idea would come up, well, actually, the Buddha hid the deepest teachings in a heaven realm, and because the immediate disciples weren't ready for it yet. And so he hid the deepest teachings in the heaven realm, and now, 500 years later, they've been brought down, and now they're being propagated. And so if you believe that, then that's fine. To me, it just seems more like the way that, you know, if you're kind of breaking away from the mainstream, or breaking away from a continuity of a lineage, then you have to justify it in some way. You say, well, in some way it's got to be better, otherwise there's no use in breaking away. So that's one way they justify it. And then the whole idea of, say, Mahayana, that was a term that they coined themselves that never existed before that. Yana means vehicle, Maha means great. And so if you're calling yourself the great vehicle, then you kind of term the other groups, the other schools, as lesser vehicle. Now the Mahayana term for that was Hina, Hinayana. Now the word Hina means low, base, or vulgar. Right? So there was never a school that would call itself voluntarily the Hinayana. It's like, well, which path do you follow, Venerable Sir? I follow the low, base, and vulgar path. And what results do you hope to expect from following the low, base, and vulgar path, Venerable Sir? Well. And then whole new scriptures started to arise. I mean, you have the Pali scriptures, and there was a very systematic tradition of keeping that going. But then about 500 years or so after that, you began to get a collection of alternative sutras, which were similar, but in many ways very different than the Pali. In different in significant ways, in ways that would in many ways kind of change the ideal. And these new scriptures were written as if the Buddha had taught those himself. Now, according to them, it did. The Buddha taught it and hid it in Tusita heaven, and then it came back down and was then presented as the Mahayana Sutras. My personal thing is, if you look at it as in a historical development, I can see how that would come about and why they would justify it that way. But if you ask me if I believe that, I personally don't believe that. Now, unfortunately, because of a lot of the basic Mahayana sutras, they still form the basis for a lot of what you find, especially in Tibetan Buddhism. So, whenever they're going through their text, it's just they keep coming back to this theme of how they're superior and the Hinayana is inferior. And, after a while it gets a bit old if you're from the Theravada tradition. And it doesn't really ring true, because a lot of the things, well, pretty much everything of what they think the Hinayana is, well, it doesn't apply to Theravada. Whatever they're defining as the Hinayana, in terms of the tenets, etc., the beliefs, the practices of Hinayana, it doesn't correspond with Theravada. But because it's so ingrained that in the Mahayana sutras, it's still difficult to get away from. And it tends to, at least for me anyways, take away from a lot of the really beautiful sutras and profound aspects in the Mahayana Buddhism. So I think they'd be more popular with Theravadins if they weren't on a superiority trip. Happy to accept them as equals. Okay. Oh, one thing I should mention. Now, the whole idea of the Bodhisattva path. Now, in Theravada Buddhism, or just original Buddhism, there was the idea of the Pali term for bodhisattva is bodhisatta. Okay, so you, the idea was that the mind is programmable, so that if a person had all of the potential to realize full enlightenment, arhanship, in that lifetime, but then out of compassion for being, you know, becoming a Buddha, one could actually renounce that, and then somehow that, you know, it actually works in the mind. If you have that much barmy or natural spiritual potential, you can actually apparently make a determination that no, I'm not going to get enlightened this lifetime, and I'm going to keep voluntarily coming back, being reborn, in order to develop all these wholesome paramis, things like generosity, kindness, patience, etc. And to the point where it's like one's spiritual potential is absolutely full, and then one can be kind of arise as a Buddha. However, there is a very long waiting list, right? And one thing that you find over and over again in the Pali Suttas is how much the Buddha is saying, get enlightened as soon as possible, right? Practice now. The future is uncertain. You know, there's never any emphasis or encouragement for people to delay their own enlightenment for the benefit of others. Because in many ways, the greatest way that we can really benefit others is by practicing now and realizing the Dhamma now and helping others right here and now. And with the arising of the Mahayana, then, that ideal of one who sacrifices one's own enlightenment in order to develop qualities for the benefit of helping others, that became more of the ideal to work towards. And if a person really knows what they're doing, then I think that has that has some merit to it, and is really worthy of respect. But for normal unenlightened people to consciously make the decision that no, I'm not going to get enlightened this lifetime, I'm going to put it off, also has some dangerous consequences, because you don't know for sure what your future rebirths are going to be like. You don't know for sure if you're going to have the opportunity to come in contact with the Dhamma. You don't know if you're going to be reborn as a human being again, or when, or where. I mean, to have the opportunity to practice the Dhamma even like this, even when we're cold and wet, you know, still extremely rare. You think of all the conditions that had to come together just to make this retreat possible. You know, it's a huge amount of causes and conditions just to make it possible so that we can sit here and do nothing. So that's good to contemplate as well, because until one has, the original idea of the Bodhisattva was that you had the potential already in that lifetime to become fully enlightened, and then you said, no, I'm going to put it off. Then you had the Bodhisattvas. The definition of a Bodhisattva is that you keep being reborn in samsara over and over again. But now the first stage of enlightenment, sotapanna, right, as soon as you've had insight that goes deep enough to realize stream entry, or sotapanna, then at most you've only got 7 more lifetimes before you become fully enlightened. So if you're on a bodhisattva path and you attain stream entry, even the first level of enlightenment, then you've blown it. Right? You've blown it. You got too much insight, and you know you can't. You just like the process has been of rebirth has been mortally wounded, and you just can't keep coming back. It's not something that's within our control, because there's no one controlling it anyways. So then, to deal with this, then the Mahayana kind of redefined Arhat, redefined Bodhisattva. And so the Arhat, instead of being the original idea of an Arhat, and still is in Theravada, is that the Buddha was an Arhat, right? And anyone who achieved full enlightenment was an Arhat. And the level of awakening between an Arhat and a Buddha was exactly the same, but the Buddha had all of these other qualities in addition to most of the Arhats. But then that got redefined as, well, Arhats, it's like a lower form of enlightenment. They're not really there yet. And it's really kind of a selfish enlightenment. And all this was like very much added later. And then the whole idea of the Bodhisattva got raised up to being, well, these beings are already enlightened, already Buddhas, etc. And then you get like whole new cosmologies coming up of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, which hadn't been there previous to that. So that's why the Mahayana Buddhism considers itself to be the major vehicle. Okay. Dear Ajahn, what practice advice would you give to someone wishing to be celibate with the intention to become free from that type of craving? In parentheses, and don't say you're a layperson, so you don't need to be celibate. Okay, I won't say that. Well, what type of practice advice would you give to someone wishing to be celibate? Well, just don't do anything. If you don't do anything, then be celibate. Just keep practicing the Dhamma. I mean, the Dhamma is gonna lead to a overcoming of all craving, right? But if you're really, I mean, if it's if for whatever reason you want to be celibate and out in the mainstream where there's a lot of there's not a whole lot of support for that, and there's a lot kind of bringing the mind back towards sensuality and romance. And romance is held up as, you know, it's a high ideal. So then, to balance that out, if you really want to be celibate, then probably you could develop this contemplation of the body that we did this morning. You know, that that can help put things in balance. There's all sorts of corpse meditations I could teach you. You know, that's hard to get. Well, for most people, it's hard to get much romantic energy going with corpses. So usually that works. A lot of the kind of popular mainstream Buddhist teachings focus on reducing anger or reducing delusion, but maybe don't focus so much on the practices that are there for reducing sensual passion. Which, you know, in monastic life, we practice those as well, practice all of those. For the reason that most people don't want to be celibate. And they do want to reduce their anger, and they do want to be more kind and forgiving, but they still want to be in relationship. And so they don't want any, start practicing things that are going to throw a wet blanket on that. But if you're intent on living a life of, for example, 8 precepts, you know, in the mainstream, then good on you. You know, go for it. The 8 precepts were designed for people living the household life, maybe even people who had families already, but wanted to live like a serious Dhamma practitioner within the mainstream, and for whatever reason, you know, weren't going to go into a monastery. So if you're living the 8 precepts, then you know, you're pretty much, you know, you're living a very almost monastic life. So those are guidelines that can be followed. And then in addition to that, come see me. I'll teach you all about the various passion-reducing corpse meditations. Ajahn, this retreat will soon end. How am I going to be able to ask questions and receive instructions afterwards? Come to New Zealand. Because it says in parentheses, from you. I mean, there are plenty of Dhamma teachers around, so it's not like I'm the only Dhamma teacher. But how will I be able to ask questions and receive instructions afterwards from you? Say, well, okay, yeah. There's this little island in the middle of the South Pacific called New Zealand, and if you want to go stay there for a while, we have places and huts for people to stay, and you're most welcome to come stay for any length of time. That's probably better. I do have email and internet, but the reality is I just don't have time to have lots of question and answer sessions with people over the internet. That just takes too much time, in addition to everything else I have to do. But to actually come and live and take part in the monastic life for a while, many people do find that very beneficial, that it just kind of sinks in. And it's not like being on a retreat, because this is a very special set of conditions. Daily monastic life is more there's more stuff happening. It's not silent all the time. There's not this much group meditation. There's a combination of individual time for practice, and but also time that we're working around the monastery. And there's group interaction, group dynamics become a very important part of the practice in a monastery. How we're relating to other people, what comes up living with a group of people. Much more than being on a retreat, where we're actually encouraged not to interact with each other. So that's all. Okay, that's the last question. Carry on with your swimming meditation.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.